How about this?
I'll move it a little bit.
Okay? Okay, good. Let's see how it goes. Right. Welcome to lecture 4, end of week 4. This is where usually people start getting a bit tired. I know it's the end of the week as well. I'm actually not feeling 100% on top of my forces myself. I should rather be in bed, but I thought I'll give the lecture anyway. I might cut down time by a few minutes. I'll see. But anyway, I thought it would be silly not to, well, to let you be here alone. But anyway. Yes. Okay, right. Okay, what are we doing today? Well, you got a lot of phonetics last time. You got a lot of symbols. You got the whole IPA alphabet. You got a lot of new vocabulary. You're going to get more on phonology. Last time you got a lot on phonetics. This time it's more on phonology. I'm going to revisit this question of phoneme again and just make that point, which I made at the end of the last lecture again. I will then look at syllables and at the internal structure of syllables and how this can be brought in connection with aspects of phonetics and phonology. And then I will finish the lecture with a look at what happens when we do what we do all the time. We produce connected speech. We don't usually produce words in separation. We say them as part of a longer stretch of speech. And in fact, if you maybe some of you have seen representations of the sound waves when we speak, and it's of course a long stretch of sounds with hardly any breaks in between, or rather the breaks are usually breaks in the voiced quality of sound, so it's not actually individual words that you can see as items on the representation in a sonograph. Okay. I will give you today, as almost always, but particularly today, I will give you a few things that are clearly beyond the basics that we need to know. And I will clarify this in the know list. So you do not have to worry about this, and I hope I make this very clear. You will hear something about, I don't know, onset maximization and things like that. Don't worry. I will make it clear what has to be known and what doesn't have to be known. And if anything is unclear, you know where to find me. Write me an email or come to my office. A quick point about writing emails. I did mention at the beginning in the first lecture how I would like to be addressed, or how I would rather, I don't mind to be addressed, but I gave you a couple of instances of how you should not address me. Remember the "Hey Prof" thing and those. I still get about half of all emails from you with "Dear Mr. Professor Dr. Hoffman" or something like that, or "Both Professor and Doctor." Have a look at that again when you write to me. It's not a major problem, and I will still answer your emails, but since I mentioned that at the beginning, just make sure, this is not just for me, but it's also how to address other people outside of the university in English. Okay, a few organizational matters. Some of you will have seen, I suspect, that the first assignment is finally up. It was uploaded to SUDIP, and I have set the deadline for this. And this is not a major piece of work. Okay, you're not going to spend hours and hours doing this, I think. The deadline is set to the 30th of November, that's a Tuesday. I wanted to make sure that people who listen to the lecture next week have enough time. So the Tuesday, not next Tuesday, but the following Tuesday, and I've set the deadline to 11 o'clock, and that's got to do with the fact that you can submit it, or that you will be asked to submit it in a print version. Last year I did this in electronic version, and that caused all sorts of problems. So I decided we'll do it very old, in an old-fashioned style this year again. So you'll be asked to print it out. You can fill it in manually, actually. It's easier for me to read if you do it on the computer and then print it out. That would be the preferred version. It would also mean it involves one or two aspects of where you, I think one, where you have to produce phonetic symbols in your answer, and that would give you an opportunity to practice using the computer to do this. Anyway, but I'll leave it up to you. The submission can be done either today in a week's time in the lecture if you feel like it. If you're finished by then, I'll just collect things here. But there's no need to do this by next Friday. You can hand it in by the following Tuesday at 11 o'clock in my secretary's office. It's all on the assignment. Please note that she's only, her office hours are only 9 to 11 o'clock, Monday to Thursday. Good. And I'd also like to remind you that the first assignment is obligatory for everyone who is either a BA or a BEd student. If you do not hand in the assignment, we are technically required not to let you do the Modulprüfung at the end of the exam. So please make sure that you do this. Okay? And I do not intend to run after you, so please make sure that you just hand it in. Okay? Yes, having mentioned the exam, I would like to say that we're still working a little bit on the exact format. We would like to improve things from last year. So I can't tell you a lot about the exam yet, but I would still like to give you a general impression of what's ahead of you a bit earlier on in the course than last year, so that you know what you can prepare for. Okay. That will happen next week. Can I also remind you again that readings are not announced in the lecture. I'm not telling you read Finnegan chapter 6 till, by the next, for next lecture. It's on the schedule, and you're expected to look at it and do this yourself. Well, find out yourself. Okay? Any other organizational issues, any other questions you'd like to ask in the plenum? Good. Right. As I said last week, we looked at the description of sounds, and of course we restricted the description largely up to the sounds that are valid or relevant for English. We looked at place of articulation, manner of articulation. We then looked at voicing and consonants. Why do I write in consonants here? Well, because vowels are by definition voiced, of course. We looked at vowel length. We also looked at aspects of lip rounding, etc. And we looked at the connection between all those aspects and the kind of sounds that are produced, and I gave you descriptions of many of those IPA symbols. Yes, I introduced you to the International Phonetic Alphabet, and I make the point that I would like you to learn this way of annotation rather than what's in Finnegan, and I know this causes some trouble because you have conflicting information, but the IPA will be better for you in the long run. Okay. And yes, as I said, we looked at sounds relevant for English. Now, I realised that it would be nice, or that it would help you, if you had a complete list of sounds and their full descriptions, whether they're voiceless and things like that. So all those aspects that we talked about. I've now copied this out of a textbook which was written by colleagues in Lancaster, where I used to teach before. And I will make this available to you as a PDF, so you have all the symbols and all the sounds and all the descriptions with sample words, and that should help you learn those by heart. And as I said, everyone who will do the exam will have to know the descriptions by heart. Okay, so that's going to be uploaded on StudIP as well. Finally, I ended the lecture on this distinction between phonetics and phonology. I mentioned that phonetics has to do with the sounds of English, with sounds of any language, just basically with representing all the sounds, not as part of a language system, while phonology has to do with sounds in the mind. Phonology has to do with what the system of, in our case, English, employs to create as building blocks for words. Okay. Oh yes, another point about last lecture. Some of you, or many of you, or most of you will remember the barrel trapezium which I mentioned. There was also some confusion I heard from, well, not confusion, but some worry from the tutorials about vowels being somewhere between low and low-mid for open, etc. Do we need to know this exactly? No, it's important that you know that something is open or closed, and if it's something is in the middle, like schwa, then you need to know that. You will not be asked to replicate this vowel trapezium sort of millimeter by millimeter anywhere. You need to have a general understanding of where a vowel can be found. Now, the other thing I did not mention, which may have confused some people, is that there are a number of footnotes. Some of these I did mention in the lecture. For example, I mentioned that the struck vowel is not existent or isn't part of northern accents, northern dialects. So someone in Lancaster, someone up in Lancaster, would say up rather than up. Okay? Well, up north, up north. Okay? The footnote I did not say anything about refers to those two elements here. That's face and goat. Okay? Now, but on the other, well, I say face and goat because I'm not a speaker of Northern English, because a speaker of Northern accents, Lancaster, for example, in Lancashire, would not actually say face, which includes a diphthong, but would actually say fist. Okay? Can't do this very well, but fist. And would not say goat, but would say gort. Okay? Now that's why it is in here, it is not part of RP or Southern Standard British English. It is part of the Northern English inventory of vowels. Now that's what the footnote is for, and that's what it says down here. So if you were confused by this, please have a look at the slide once I upload it onto our Sudaip. Good. Let's start with a bit more revision from last time, and in fact I would like you to look at those four transcriptions, phonetic transcriptions, which are actually two minimal pairs. Just for 20 seconds, can you write down, either actually write down or just metaphorically write down what the English words would be in orthographic transcription. Okay. Now, these are team and deem. Okay. And there are thy and thy, okay, old pronoun. Thy will be done. Okay. Now, why do I mention those here? Because they are minimal pairs, which means that there is only one sound which is changed, and that creates a different word. It creates a difference in meaning. Okay. Sometimes we don't only have minimal pairs. In fact, we have minimal sets, okay? Hen, men, den. It's only one sound which changes, but it's the same principle at work. And we used this already last time to establish whether a word, whether a sound is a phoneme in that sense, okay? Or whether two sounds are part of the same phoneme or whether we are talking about different phonemes. So we use this as a procedure to establish that voiced and voiceless stops, for example, are phonemes in English, because we have words where the same plosive in terms of place of articulation, etc., is used. The only thing that changes is voicing, and we will create a different word out of this. Meaning distinguishing. Now, most of what I said last week was actually a very broad phonetic transcription. So I introduced "p" as the bilabial voiceless plosive. But towards the end of the lecture, I introduced aspects like aspiration, where I made the point that depending on the position in the word, in the syllable, or whether it's at the onset of a word, at the beginning of a word, there may actually be slightly different ways of producing the same sound. And I made the point with the pair pit versus spit. Notice I didn't say minimal pair, I just said pair. It's two words. Okay? So this is not a minimal pair. Or is it? Let's forget. Is that a minimal pair as well? It's not a minimal pair because we add something. Okay, no, all right. As I said, today I'm not on top of the... Okay. Okay, but the point I made, and that what I'm sure about, is that p, when it is aspirated, okay, when there is this p, as in pit, and p without the aspiration, cannot produce a minimal pair in English. There is no word where just changing the aspiration to non-aspiration, or the p to p, vice versa, will not produce a minimal pair. And we came to the conclusion that, therefore, both are allophones of the same phoneme. And this, in this case, has to do with the position in the syllable. At the beginning of a word or not. Now, if this is sufficient to explain everything, and if you've done the reading in Finnegan, then you may remember this here, where we look at not only position in the word, okay, but we're looking at other aspects as well, namely stress as well. We have the aspirated word at the beginning of the word, where it is stressed, pedigree, personal, persecute, pilgrimage, etc. Okay. But here we have a different stress. Okay. It's on the second syllable. But still we have the aspirated P because it is at the beginning of the word. Right? This is stressed as well. It's not the first syllable of the words, but it's still stressed, therefore with an aspiration. And here we have rapid, empathy, competition. Okay, so the word, the syllable is not stressed and it's not word initial, and that's where the aspiration does not happen. So it's several factors that contribute to the choice between the two. Notice that it is clear where the aspirated perk happens and where it doesn't. There will be, well, we find this, but we don't find it the other way around. So we can't sort of juggle them around however we feel like. Okay? It is determined by the environment in which a particular sound is found in, okay, in which it is found. Okay? This is what's called complementary distribution. It's, if a certain environment is given, then this variant is used, and if another variant and another environment will cause another variant to be used. Now, this isn't necessarily always the case. If we look at the word mop, we can use this with or without an audible release at the end. And this seems to occur in three variations. This is the same words, and it doesn't really depend on whether it's part of a larger sequence, etc. Well, it probably will to some extent, but just looking at those words in, or this word in isolation, this is the case. So there's a difference between complementary distribution and free variation. You will hear more about free variation in the context of social linguistics next term. I'll say a few more words in this lecture too. Last week I mentioned that the t and the glottal stop are actually allophones of the phoneme t. Is this a case of complementary distribution, or is this a case of free variation? Let's do it with a show of hands. Who is in favor of complementary distribution? Okay. Who is in favor of free variation? Who doesn't know? Who doesn't care? Okay. All right. Well, this is not a case of complementary distribution. Whether you say water bottle or water bottle does not depend on the position of the sound with respect to other elements in the words, in the word position in the syllable, in preceding vowels, preceding consonant, etc., etc. Is this free variation? Well, free variation in the sense that I introduced it so far, yes, but of course it is not free variation in the sense that it has, well, it is indicative of certain aspects of language use or language users. This is something that you will be hearing more in the next term, as I said, but someone who says water bottle is more likely to be of a certain, let's say, social class or age group or lives in a certain region. But from the point of view of being variants within the same phoneme, these are not in complementary distribution and they are in free distribution. In fact, some people disagree about whether we can then still talk about allophones, but let's not go into this. This is not necessary now. Right, as I said, next semester you'll be doing social linguistics and that's where this concept will come back. Let's look a little bit more at phonemes and allophones, and their allophones. Can you look at those words and tell me whether the sound L, or not the sound L, the phoneme L, is always pronounced in the same way? And if not, why not? If I ask like that, then it's quite likely that it's not. But why not? Anyone? Milk, leak, look, wealth, calls, asleep, seldom. You can say them yourself if you want to find out whether. Okay. Can you say what actually happens in a way? Yeah, you mentioned two words, the milk and tall. Is that, were you going to say the same? It's almost forward. Like a vowel. Okay, all right, yes. Yeah, okay. Now, can we agree on the fact that those four have the same kind of L? Milk, well, okay, I'm trying to overdo this now, calls, seldom, okay, and then we have leak, look, asleep, okay. We have a dark L, and a clear L, and the position of the tongue is slightly different. And this has got to do with what? What do all those words have in common in terms of position? Well, isn't there always a vowel before the L? Here we have it in syllable initial position. This is a term you don't have to learn. velarization. But you know, you've heard about the velum. And what actually happens is that the back of the tongue is raised towards the soft palate, and that produces a slightly different sound. Yeah? Just to make sure that this is repeated, no, you don't have to learn this term, and you don't need to be able to apply it actively. But can you see how, and this is a question of complementary distribution again, depending on where it occurs in respect to other elements in the word, or in the syllable, depending on where this occurs, the quality of the sound which realizes the phoneme will change slightly. It will become more dark in certain cases when it follows a vowel, because of velarization. Now in the case of L versus RU, only one phoneme is involved. This velarization happens to this phoneme. Do we have any difference between the first sounds of these pairs of words? Teeth versus tool. Peel versus pool. Kill versus call. Is anything different? They're always plosives. They are produced at different places in the mouth, and they always, the second word always contains a rounded vowel, where the lips are rounded. And this has an influence on the preceding consonant. This is called labialization. No, you don't have to learn labialization as a term. But I'm interested in you realizing what kind of concepts are around and the general concept of phoneme versus phone. So if we wanted to transcribe this, not in a broad phonetic transcription, but more narrowly, then more delicate transcription, then we would use the t in teeth like this. And because this precedes a rounded vowel, we would indicate this with a little W, because that sort of it indicates that the lips are rounded. Okay. So this is a phonological rule. All consonants undergo this labialization before rounded vowels. And we could say that the rounded consonants, if you want to call them like that, are all allophones, and their unrounded counterparts are allophones of the same phoneme. Okay? So this is a general, much more general rule rather than the one with the dark and the clear L that I introduced. This has got to do also with the way we produce, with ease of production. I'll come back, or ease of pronunciation. I'll come back at the end of the lecture to that. How do you transcribe the word open? I'll give you 15 seconds to think about that. How would you transcribe the word open? Open. Particularly the latter part of the word. Some of you who've already got some experience and do this quickly would perhaps have done this. But is this actually a representation of what we produce when we speak? Do I say open? Open? Or don't I rather say open? Open? You can say this yourself. Open? Isn't this rather an M in a way, which is syllabic, which happens, well, which behaves as if it was a syllable, so it's a syllabic nasal, and it follows another consonant. Notice that this is in no way specific to English. There are words in German where this happens all the time. Haben. Do you say haben? No, haben. Haben. You don't say vernünftig. You say vernünftig with an M. Okay. More rules. Vowels can be short or long. And in fact, long vowels and diphthongs are said to belong to the same kind of class, and we'll come back to that later on when we talk about syllable structure. Is vowel length contrastive in English? Or, in other words, can we find a minimal pair where the only thing that changes is vowel length? I may have asked this before, I can't remember now. Can you find any minimal pairs? Well, the answer is no. So vowel length itself doesn't seem to be, well, you can't produce two allophones of the same phoneme simply by changing the vowel length. But vowel length isn't random. We say wing, bang, strength, and hung. There are no words wing, barn, stain, or whatever, and hung. Why? Well, for example, there is a rule that vowels before m must be short in English. Again, no, I don't expect you to learn that rule by heart. Okay, just to make that point a couple of times now during this lecture. Let's see whether you can deduct this rule. We have C, bar, law, and strain. Short or long? Long or diphthong, right? Okay. We don't have English words C, ba, lo, and strain. First three sound almost Chinese to me. I don't know, I'm not a speaker of Chinese, but could be, right? But we do have sip, bat, lock, and stress. Can anyone deduct what the rule is about vowel length? How many syllables are involved? Yep.
A short vowel has to have a consonant on the end.
Okay. If it's a long monosyllabic, my brain today, as I said, but monosyllabic content words with open syllables can only exist with long vowels and diphthongs. Okay. If, on the other hand, a short vowel is involved, then it must be what we will call a closed syllable. There must be something at the end of syllable which is a consonant. Okay. Another rule then. Here's another one, very important rule. And that's one I would actually like you to remember. And I've already mentioned this before. A vowel in unstressed syllable always becomes schwa. Okay. The lazy vowel. Okay. So if you look at the contrast between those two words, photograph versus photography.
Photograph? No.
Or library versus librarian. Then in cases where a stress shifts, the unstressed vowel moves in the direction of the schwa or is actually realized as the schwa. Here's the transcription. Okay. So the first one, the first diphthong turns into a schwa when it is photography. Okay? Well, turns into, it's two different words. Well, we've got the contrast here. Alright? Now, as I said before, different languages have different phonemes, and that was my example of the Spanish and their problems with the vowels, okay, for example. Or they may have different phonological rules, but use the same phones, of course, the same sounds. What about German speakers? How do they say those two words? Pretty much the same, isn't it? In German. But that's because of different phonological rules in German, and this then produces problems for speakers of English with native tongues, with the native tongue German. How do German speakers produce the word jazz? Well, they don't necessarily say jazz, but they say, what is it, jazz? Well, I can't even do this. Chess. Yes, okay, it's the game, isn't it? The game of chess. Okay? Well, almost. Okay. So that can cause problems for language learners, of course. And vice versa. English speakers and their problems of producing words like, well, not tsar, but or tsunami, right? Not tsunami. Because in their phonological system, there is no syllable initial or word initial. Okay? That's why it's Zurich and not Zurich. And of course we have tried people, or we have heard English people try to produce München, and we know how they fail. Okay. But that again has to do with the fact that the phonological inventory is not the same, even though some of the sounds are actually the same, and some others are not there at all. In the case of U, this is not part of the phonology of English. Some dialects have it, but anyway. Yes, dialects. Okay, next thing I would like to say. I've already indicated that there is a difference between goat and goat, and face and face. Okay. And I've briefly mentioned, but I didn't show it to you on the slide, that we can use several terms to refer to these ways of these accents. You may have heard of RP, the received pronunciation. Queen's English sometimes is the term that's used in this context. Southern Standard British English. Okay. And you've got northern varieties of British English, and you've got, of course, American English. And I think Professor Stubbs is currently doing, or has recently done, a lecture on regional accents and teaching English. Okay. So this should ring a bell. Let's have a quick look at American English. Okay. And of course you've read about American English in Finney. Now these four diphthongs are actually absent in American English. Why is that? Does anyone remember? Well, there is a major difference. American English is what's called a rhotic dialect. No, it has nothing to do with erotic, no? Yeah. Okay. But it's a good way to remember it, okay? For the exam. Okay. For example, in Standard Southern British English, we have the word fear, where the American counterpart, general American, would do something like fear. Well, I can't do this. Fears. No, okay. Sometimes I produce it, but sometimes I don't. But I guess you know the point. That you get the point. Care versus care. Care. Yeah. Okay. Good. You can do it better than I can do. What is it? Well, erotic accent has produces the post-vocalic R. And this is the case in general American, in most areas of the United States, not in all. On the other hand, there are some areas in Britain left where the rhotic R still exists, in the South, West, Cornwall, etc., and some areas of Lancashire, for example. But really, we have, in a way, fewer vowels in British English, in American English, and in British English. So the loss of this post-vocalic R, which we presume must have been there early on, have had a major impact on the vowel system of English. A few more points about American English. What's the difference between the vowels in those two words? I'm not even trying to produce it, but maybe you can try. Well, there is no difference. Both of them are the same. Or here's another one where the difference basically disappears that would exist in British English. Ladder versus ladder. Well, it's the same. Okay. Remember I introduced the North American tap last lecture, or the flap. Okay. Now what this actually does, now that we know a little bit more about phones and phonemes and the facts, well, and what this all means, is what happens in American English is that a phonemic contrast which exists in British English is neutralized, doesn't exist anymore. So in that sense, American and British English don't have the same phonemic inventory. Right, it's about mid-lecture, so let's have a quick productive break of about 2 minutes. Can you try to transcribe those five words? Perhaps knowing, well, not knowing, perhaps using some of what I've said over the last 45 minutes about assimilation and about certain sounds becoming, for example, nasalized syllables, etc., etc. Okay, so I'll give you a few, maybe 2 minutes to do this. And if you don't want to do this, then this is the moment to chat with your neighbor. Okay, shall we continue? Let's see whether you have the same. Okay. The issue here is, well, the first three symbols should be no problem. Hey. We've got a diphthong here. But then the question is, what happens with bo? Is there a schwa, or is there actually no schwa, or is there some kind of syllabic L? In fact, some people disagree about this, but I've asked phoneticians about this, and they feel that there is actually no schwa involved, but it makes more sense to say that the L is syllabic. Okay? Now, what about water? I have two options here. The first one is without, and the first one with a glottal stop. Okay.
water, water, or water.
Okay. How did you transcribe the next word? Well, it depends on where you are, really. If you are a northerner, then you would not transcribe it like this. You would not say laugh. Okay. You would say laugh. Laugh. Or people talk about the castle rather than the castle. And how did you transcribe there and fur? Well, there, if you are not a speaker of erotic dialect or accent, sorry, then there is no little R-like thing attached to this, okay, but it's a simple diphthong. And fur is different, that's the nurse vowel. Okay. Again, if you're a speaker of Northern English, you would transcribe it different. See? You would say, well, you would use the same sounds. Okay. This is something I really have to get used to at the beginning, that people up north, or up north, would say the rather than there. The and fur. I can't even produce this, okay? Right, so that's covered the basic concepts of a phoneme again, some rules about changes that are regular depending on the immediate environment that are found in complementary distribution, and we've also introduced a few differences according to different dialects or regions, and I've mentioned that social class and age, etc., can also come into the picture. I'd like to move over now to the next subtopic, which is, I'd like to say a few more words about synonyms. Again, this will be more specific than what you have to learn for the exam, but hey, this is supposed to be a lecture on something that is a little bit advanced as well. I know it's an introductory lecture, but you should be able to see what that there is interesting stuff out there. Okay. We've already seen, of course, and we know that there are words with one syllable and more syllables, monosyllabic or polysyllabic words. How many syllables do those two words have? Understand, sending, okay, I guess that's pretty easy to count. What's perhaps a little bit more difficult is what the boundaries are between those syllables and how we can motivate those boundaries. Is it, for example, sending? Is it sending? Or is it sending? I'll come back to that at the end of that subsection, and you can then see whether your hunches have been confirmed. We have certain rules about what a syllable looks like and what it consists of, what the structure is, what the initial elements in the syllable are, and what the final elements are, and these are the general rules which apply to English. Thank you. Okay. For example, in the syllable pig, one syllable, okay, we can distinguish between an onset in the syllable and the rhyme. And the rhyme in itself is separated into the nucleus and the coda. Okay. So here are four more terms for you. The nucleus is the required element, which is basically the head of the syllable. We will come back to concepts like heads later on when we do syntax. Okay. So that's why I thought I'd mention this concept here as well. Again, in syntax, the head of a phrase, for example, will be obligatory and will be, well, the phrase will be called after it. Now, this is the structure of the word pig. Let's look at the next one. We've got the word lay. Again, monosyllabic. We've again got an onset. But now the rhyme looks different because we have no final consonant. We have a long vowel, or rather a diphthong, and that means we have sort of a split nucleus. Actually, sorry. Let me just run this through again. Yes, okay. Same thing for the word C, which is, that's why I was confused, sorry, which is not a diphthong, but which is a long vowel. And I mentioned that long vowels and diphthongs are in the same sort of category. If we have a more complex syllable, like strives, then this looks as follows. We've got a more complex onset with three sounds, and the rhyme consists of a nucleus and a coda, which now also consists of two phones or phonemes. We can have multisyllabic or polysyllabic words like city, which consist of, well, all those different types. And I'm not going to go through all the different options now, but just to show you what people have come up with for something like city, we've got an onset, we've got a very simple rhyme, namely consisting only of a nucleus, and of course the same again in the second syllable. The rhyme does not branch, there is no long vowel, there is no coda. This is why it's called a light syllable. If, on the other hand, we have something like this that we've seen for lay, then we have a heavy syllable. Another heavy syllable, of course, when a coda is involved. Now, why am I telling you all of this? This has got to do with various aspects of structure, including aspects of stress, etc. We have the words volcano, aroma, and potato. Veranda, agenda, disaster, synopsis, and cinema, avenue, and liberty. These have all three syllables. In fact, there is something that's called a trisyllabic noun stressor. They're also nouns. Again, this is not something that you need to know by heart. Just interesting observation. Stress is on the second but last, on the penultimate syllable, if it is heavy. What does it mean it's heavy? Well, if it's, for example, got a branched nucleus or if there is a coda. But stress is on the ante-penultimate, so the one before the second last syllable, if the second last syllable is light. Let's look at this. We've got an unstressed syllable here. No, sorry. Stress is on the on the third last if the penultimate syllable is light. In all these cases, we do not have a heavy syllable because there is no coda or no diphthong. Okay. An observation. We've already seen that syllables can behave differently depending on whether there is a coda or not. This was the observation that you made, that when it is a closed syllable, then it can be in monosyllabic content words. It can be It can be a short vowel. Hello? This doesn't click. Oh dear. Oh, it clicks again. Okay. So the open syllable consists of no coda. It could consist of a single vowel, in fact. Something like the word or. But in a closed syllable, we have one or several consonants. At, ants, etc. So we've got a structure, vowel, consonant, consonants in this case. In fact, we can have a rather complex structure, as in splints, which is three consonants in the onset and three consonants in the coda. And languages seem to have rules for what it's what is possible to combine in syllables. This is the last bit I'm going to say about syllable structure, and this is really for people who would like to find out more. There seems to be two principles at work: the onset maximization principle and the sonority sequencing principle. For example, the onset maximization principle says that if everything else is equal, prioritize the allocation of consonants. Put the consonants in the onset rather in the coda. Okay? Now this will help us determine whether it's sen or ding or whatever. I'll come to that in a minute. Or actually, I'll come to it now. This one is actually a violation of that principle which I've just mentioned. Okay. If everything is equal, the consonant should be, the onset of the second syllable shouldn't be empty. Okay. On the other hand, this is also not compatible with another rule, namely the sonority sequencing principle, which you do not need to know about, but it's got to do with different sounds in English being more or less sonorous. Something like p is not sonorous at all, but vowels obviously are the other extreme. Okay? And then there are sounds in the middle which are more or less sonorous, and that will have an influence on where they can be placed. Okay? So, if we look at sen ding, then both of these principles are satisfied, and that gives us the syllable structure. Okay, a few words about syllables. I've just finished. The syllable structure bit is of minor importance. What is of more importance is what happens in connected speech. Here is a wonderful but very wrong quote from a Lancaster exam script. Someone who speaks received pronunciation would pronounce all their consonants at the end of words, whereas a Cockney from London would not. Okay. Well, is this really true? I've already said this is wrong, and I would like to suggest that we quickly listen to the Queen, who, after all, I would expect would know something about the Queen's English, or RP, or something like that. And I would like you to listen to what she says. This is from a speech she gave when her mother died, and she would, and I would like you to listen to whether she actually produces consonants at the end of all the words. Now, for those of you who are listening not here, but in the online, I know there's a problem with echo. Right? This has got to do with the fact that, well, once the computer records it and once it records it again later through the monitors or through the loudspeakers, I could switch this off, but the problem would be that this is still on here, so there will be an echo anyway. I will upload those things separately, so that you have to look at those clips separately. But let's listen to her now, and please listen to the way she produces word final consonants.
Concerning tomorrow, I hope that sadness will blend with a wider sense of thanksgiving, not just for her life, but for the times in which she lived. A century for this country and the Commonwealth, not without its trials and sorrows, but also one of extraordinary progress, full of examples of courage and service, as well as fun and laughter. This is what my mother would have understood, because it was the warmth and affection of people everywhere which inspired her resolve, dedication and enthusiasm for life. I thank you for the support you are giving me and my family as we come to terms with her death and the void she has left in our midst. I thank you also from my heart for the love you gave her during her life and the honour you now give her in death. May God bless you all.
Okay. Did she pronounce all the consonants at the end of words? Well, no, but which one? Sorry? Also? No, okay, right, yes? Understood? Okay, I'm not sure about that one, but we can listen to that again, yes?
Hard.
Yeah? She did say. She did, yes, okay, yes, okay, maybe, yeah? Yeah, she did. The R at the end, okay, there's one word which is very frequent in the English language, which ends in... Okay, which word are you referring to?
And.
Right, and, okay. Country and Commonwealth. Trials and sorrows, etc. Now, she does produce some of those, you can listen at that again, listen to that again, when I upload it, but I'd like to play you one particular one where I feel, and I haven't actually tested this with any technical equipment, but I don't think she actually says it, and this is the following.
Fun and laughter, 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 fun and laughter.
Okay, I think she says fun and laughter. Okay. And this is because it's connected speech. So even the Queen does it. This is a joke that relies on this principle. When you've seen a shopping mall, when you've seen one shopping centre, you've seen them all. Yeah. I didn't say it was a good joke, okay? But you get the point, right? Connected speech does something to the way we produce, well, certain sounds, and we interpret boundaries, okay, in this case. In fact, in connected speech, we find combinations, impositions of a syllable that are simply illegal in English. Well, illegal, if we look at it from the point of view that we've done so far in this lecture. For example, the word, or not the word, sequence, it is cold. Well, if you want to put this into some kind of, let's say, citation form, if you produce it very carefully, then this would be the way it would be described. But in connected speech, we would produce it, it's cold. Yeah, right, it's cold. Now, is not a legal syllable onset in English. But it is perfectly okay in connected speech because various things are reduced, etc., etc. These are assimilation processes in connected speech. This is an important process, and there are two types. For example, if we look at that place, well, it's not that place, but it's that place. Right? Or, that keen is not that keen, but that keen. Right? Or this one, it's not horseshoe, but horseshoe. Right? Now, what's at issue here? It's the place of articulation where the second consonant is produced. So this is what's called a place of articulation assimilation. This is very common. We also have the other option. If we have something like, or another option, that scene, in connected speech, it would be that scene. Okay. This is odd without looking at longer stretches of text, of course. Or a good newspaper. Good newspaper. Mm-hmm. Now, what changes here is not the place, but more the manner of articulation. This is much less common. So the place remains the same. We also have quite frequently the case where certain consonants are simply dropped, okay, or reduced. Yeah. As you can see, elision of reduced vowel after voice and stuff. Yeah, okay, sorry. The drop consonant will come in a minute. We don't say potato, potato. Okay. Or correct, rather than correct. Or, well, not because, but cause. Okay? And in fact, what happens here is two things. On the one hand, something gets dropped or gets elided. Okay? But what also happens is, look at this here. What is this? What is this p? It's voiceless. Okay? But of course, because the first sound there is a voiced p. So the voiced plosive actually assimilates in this process of elision to the following voiceless one. Okay, here's the point that I wanted to make before about dropping certain consonants, particularly word final ones. For example, how would you produce last person? Well, not like this, but it would actually be last person. Okay. Last person. Or not Fifth Street, but Fifth Street. Okay. And that's very much related also to basically what the Queen did in her speech, because it's connected. In fact, other Englishes, and this is again something that you may hear more about when you are in your second term, second semester, do this much more so than what happens in connected standards or southern standard British English. Okay. I've got a quick extract here from a Singapore English speaker where English is now, well, where it's on the verge of becoming a fully native language, okay, with a slightly, well, not only slightly, with quite different features, but it's still English spoken natively by many people. And this is what it sounds like, or one version of it.
So generally, most of the areas that we visited were very, rural. It's not town, it's actually very laid back.
Okay. I'll just put this up again and play the last bit again. What does he say? Well, first of all, rural is very oddly pronounced. But what he says is actually not town, but it's more like tau. Okay. And it's not laid back, but it's laid back. Okay, just listen again. Oops, sorry.
Rural is not town, it's actually very laid back.
Okay. So, much more common in other accents and dialects of English. For example, they tend to also avoid consonant clusters. Here is a woman saying exciting.
Exciting. Exciting.
Yeah. So it's a reduction of a cluster, and in that sense, a simplification. So different rules may apply in different dialects as well, and not only in different accents of the British Isles or British versus American English, but it may actually be quite different in certain other Englishes. Okay, and that, don't wrap up yet. I just want to summarize the important points. Okay, that brings me to the end of the lecture on phonetics and phonology. What we covered was the sounds of English and how they are produced. Okay. We looked at place and manner of articulation and other things. But people still pack up, okay? Okay. We looked at broad phonetic transcription. Okay. I hope I got across what the difference between a phone and a phoneme is. If not, can I please remind you that there is a tutorial? And I still get emails from people about whether they can be added to the list. Yes, it is possible. And please remember, I really, really, really need your matricule number and the slot that you would like to join. Otherwise, I simply can't do it. Well, I could put you into any slot, but I can't do it without a matricule number. Okay. We also looked at phonetic transcription, and that's where the square brackets are used. And then, because we have the system which is specific to English, where different sounds may be allophones of the same phoneme, in order to make this apparent in the transcription, we use the phonemic transcription. I also said lots of other things about syllable structure and onset maximization principle and things like that. This is the main thing that you need to go away with. And I will again make that clear in the no list, which I will distribute for the two lectures that we've just completed. Which means I can go to bed about 15 minutes earlier.